This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick at rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Florida Spectacular. Rick, how are you?
I'm ready to talk about native plants.
So listeners, those of you playing the home game, we did a beautiful, intricate opening for this episode, and I forgot to hit record, so we are now redoing it. But long story short, Rick had an interesting weekend. I love the rain. Summer is here. We're both planting things in our yard that are native, and we are doing kind of a special in that it was not something we intended to do, but it came across our table or our desk kind of late last week that the there is a native plant and the last wild population of the native plant is under siege. And what's going on is that there is a proposed tollway going through Polk County that is going to basically, if it's built as intended, it would be a death knell for the last wild population of the federally endangered mint blushing scrub bomb. And so what we're here, we got, we really appreciate two people, Gene Kelly and Valerie Anderson from the Florida Native Plant Society. They rearranged their schedules to talk to everyone about what's going on, why it matters, and what, if anything, you can do about this. And, you know, listeners, I know it's been exhausting. We are not a podcast that usually urges people to action, but I know a lot of you who listen to us probably also listen to As Bad As It Gets or The Madcaps or any number of Florida podcasts where there's been a lot of action and there's been a lot of drama surrounding some of Florida's wild places. But I am, if you listen to the podcast or you read a lot of my essays or my books, you know that my soft spot is trees and plants in peril. We've talked about this on the podcast before where if you come to my house, I can show you all the house plants and tell you where they were dying and left for dead when I had to rehabilitate them. So when I hear about this last little bit of this mint that is in danger, I'm like, well, we have to fix it. But Valerie, Gene, is it even possible to fix it? Talk to us about what's happening and what about the plant makes it exceptional and why we care if it's destroyed forever.
Okay. Well, I'll provide a little context first. First of all, Dicerandra modesta, that is the Latin name for the scrushing, blushing scrub balm. And that is one of a number of species, both plant and animal species, that are extremely limited in their natural range, associated with the Lake Wales Ridge. Runs basically north-south through Highlands and Polk counties. It's a biodiversity hotspot, world-renowned for the number of narrow endemic species associated with it. Endemic means that's the only place they occur. So this Dicerandra modesta, the blushing scrub balm, is one of those narrow endemic species, limited, in this case, not just to the Lake Wales Ridge of Highlands and Polk County, but as far as we know, to just this one location in Polk County. Thankfully, it is on public land. But the distinction is, you know, why should we care about it? It's because this is one of those species that is really just totally unique to Florida. It's actually the oldest part of Florida. So these are ancient plants. If you think about the Lake Wales Ridge, it's the highest topographic feature in the Florida Peninsula. And when sea levels were much higher, that was the only part of Florida that was above water. And so sea levels receded And then, you know, the rest of the peninsula was exposed. But this is the most ancient landmass, if you will, of Florida. So it's very unique in that respect. And Valerie, you might want to add some stuff to that.
Sure. So, not only is this plant extremely limited in its geographic scope, it's recently described. These mints are really interesting in that they have evolved over the course of sea level rise and fall in Florida. And so you may have heard of Lacolla's mint or Titusville balm. There's a bunch of different mints in Florida, and they have all evolved fairly recently in geographic time. And you can't identify the mints all year. They're beautiful flowers that you'll see in the show notes and in the podcast overview. Those are only there in late fall, so late October, early November, sometimes late September. And it's called blushing scrub balm because the pink blush across the flowers is very, very beautiful. But you can identify it year round if you step on it, which it's pretty easy to do. In this particular site, it's pretty well established. Like, it's these big circular masses, big mounds of plants, the older plants. We call them Volkswagens. They can get pretty big, 4 or 6 feet across, and the whole thing flowers. So it's really awesome. But the smaller plants are they're pretty they're, they can be pretty small, like little seedlings of 3 inches tall, to medium-sized individuals of 6 inches around, 12 inches around. When you
Now,
step
you
on
said
them.
it's a mint. Is it edible? Could I put this in my iced tea instead of the mint I have growing in a pot?
Yes, all it tastes good and it's edible. Now, there is some research that all of the native Florida mints have some level of hepatotoxicity, but you can eat it in small quantities.
What's a small quantity? Let's just keep the
Like a
podcast from
tea.
getting sued.
A tea
Like a
is
tea. So
fine.
not like a mint casserole. That would be bad.
Just don't go out and make a big pot of this and put it in your smoothie,
Is
for
this
10 or 10 days
and
in a
also don't
row.
go pick it because it's wildly
Right.
endangered.
And you cannot pick it. It's illegal because it's
But you could
federally
probably
endangered. This is a federally endangered plant. So possession
no,
of this plant is not legal.
I noticed in your Instagram post that caught my attention, you said the last wild population. Could people buy it somewhere and grow it if they wanted to?
Well, it's not in the nursery trade. So there's
Oh,
nowhere
not
to
at all.
find
Okay.
it. Now, if you happen to find some, or happened upon some seeds, however you would happen upon those seeds, they propagate just like other dicerandras, really well from cuttings. The seed viability is low, but they produce tons of seeds. So this is something that people could grow. It is definitely possible to grow, especially in the areas around like Davenport, near where the site is, the rest of Polk County. It's going to be really easy to grow if you had like a high and dry sandy site, but you can't currently get it anywhere.
It looks to me, the closest thing I've seen, at least in a commercial nursery that I've planted before, is bee balm or horse mint. Is it related to that?
I mean, all the mints are related. That's why
Okay.
you call them mints. But those are not very closely related
Okay.
when it comes to the mints.
Because I kept thinking it looked familiar, and then it's like it kind of looks like those other ones that are commercially available. So how can we help? I mean, what's the best thing we can do?
Yeah, so right now the public comment period ended for FDOT. So they set these, bookends on when you can comment on different phases of the project. So they had a route that went right through. Thankfully, they nixed that route, and we are just in a route that comes. There's the routes. They have two routes that are basically the same right by the site, and one gets closer and one gets a little farther away. Like 400 feet and 1,000 feet, that kind of distances. We're still pretty bad for management of the site because this is fire maintained high scrub, which means stand replacing fires every 12 to 15 years. And of course they manage it with roller chopping, so they don't have to burn the whole thing. But basically the road at that distance would make managing the property impossible. I mean, if not impossible, extremely difficult. And by extremely difficult, we mean staff intensive, equipment intensive, time intensive, which are all things that are not currently in play in this property. The managers office is over on the east side of St. Cloud. And they manage like another 20,000 acres. So currently this property is not intensively managed. And so thus we have great concern about the potential for this toll road to negatively impact the property.
All right. So let's just stop for a second and talk. When you say it's not intensely managed, who owns the, it's publicly owned property, right?
Yes. So it is owned two parts. It, like all the, like lots of conservation land in Florida, it's sort of a complicated ownership and protection. So it is owned by, part of it is owned by South Florida Water Management District. Part of it is owned by Southwest Florida Water Management District.
Oh.
And then it is managed mostly by South Florida Water Management District, whose office is in St. Cloud, but also in cooperation with FWC.
So what happens if they build the road? Specifically, what do you envision happening if they build the road? That's going to be a problem. When you say intense management, let's talk about this for people who are lucky enough not to live in this world. Yeah, well, of
Valerie, you know, made the point that stand replacing fire. A lot of Florida consists of fire dependent natural habitats, but they can vary according to the way they burn and the frequency with which they burn. And in the case of scrub habitat like this, it burns less frequently than a pine flatwoods or other pine habitat would. And when it does burn, it burns much more intensely. And so those plants are designed basically due to the intensity of the fire, their life history strategy. The stuff above ground is gone, but they survive underground. So the root mass will survive and they'll resprout after the fire. In the case of some species, you know, that don't resprout like that, they have to come back from a seed bank, seeds that persist in the soil, and that's how they reappear on the site. In the case of this species, Valerie, I don't know if this is one that the plant would actually succumb to the fire and then be dependent on a seed bank.
So it would, you know, if the entire site was burned, that's what would happen. And then, you know, all the above ground parts of the plant would die. And most of the roots, most likely the roots would die. If you can translate some of the research on the other Lake Wells Ridge scrub balms, which I believe you can, and other researchers say that you can't. And so what you'd be doing is there'd be a seed bank in the soil, you'd get a lot of new seedlings. But then this particular site has these really cool xeric islands where they've roller chopped around and managed and fire excluded around scrub oak, little small hammocks. And so those would be really difficult to burn and would likely not even burn in a very hot fire. And so those populations would probably, those mini tiny subpopulations would probably stay there, and even if there was a really large fire. And of course, this property is divided into multiple areas. And so if you're prescribed burning versus, say, a natural burning from a fire, if this was 100 years ago, you know, and you had like a fire sweeping across Florida or a lightning caused fire, that's not going to happen. There's a power line right of way through the site. And there's obviously, you know, fire breaks. So because we have to manage these sites, because things are not the way they were and ecological processes are not happening in the way that they would have in the past, we would have obviously, you know, plants on one side, no matter what the fire happened, no matter how the fire behaved and how, what conditions it was burned under, whereas the other side obviously would have to be burned later.
Let's real briefly explain to some of our listeners who maybe aren't as familiar. And we do have a couple listeners who are younger, what the fire cycle is and why it matters, why there are plants that are fire dependent and how development interrupts the fire cycle. Can you do a simplified fire cycle?
Yeah. And then, you know, there are a lot of people who are probably new to Florida who don't understand, you know, some of the environmental factors involved.
Or who have been brainwashed by a smoky bear saying only you can prevent forest fires, which is patently untrue.
Okay,
sorry, Smokey.
California.
Well, Florida, I would just bring up, as a contrast to a site like this scrub, a pine flatwoods. That's a forest dominated by pine, longleaf or slash pine or a combination. And typically we consider those to have a natural fire return interval of every 2 to 3 years, very frequent.
And meaning that there will be a fire that occurs naturally every 2 to 3 years.
Right. If we had
necessary.
Yes. If we hadn't come along and changed the landscape the way we have, a natural lightning strike could have started a fire and burned large areas. And an area like that would have been subject to fire on that kind of frequency. And what we find is there are a lot of plant species that if they don't burn, they will basically go senescent. So wiregrass is one of the most important species for carrying fire in a pine flatwoods. And it took us a while to learn this, but if it doesn't burn, but if it doesn't burn in the growing season, it will never flower and produce seed. So these plants have adapted over thousands of years to respond to fire. And in large part, it's based on how frequently they're exposed to that fire. And a scrub, like the one where Valerie's doing this plant work, it's really high, dry, it's sand. There's no fertility there. So after it burns, it takes a long time for it to recover so that you will have the plant mass there to carry a fire again. So it's all these different variables that come into play that would dictate how often a particular habitat type might burn and how aggressively. So a pine flatwoods that burns every couple of years, it can be a quick, cool fire. It doesn't kill the trees. The shrubs sprout back. The wiregrass is going to flower the next summer. But in the case of a scrub, it takes a much longer time to recover. And the fire is so hot when it does happen that it's what we call stand replacing. It kills things. The pine you would find there is sand pine, and they die in the fire. So in contrast to those pine forests, pineland forests, the trees would actually be killed by the fire. And then you can even look at things like, the time it takes for a sand pine to go from a seed to a tree that's producing pine cones with seeds. And that's on the order of 8 to 10 years. It has to start producing seed again quickly, because if the next fire comes along before it's had a chance to do that, it can just disappear from the site. So they're all, all these species are just so in tune to the fire and the frequency with which it occurs. And as we learn more and more, even the time of year when it occurs. And typically a natural fire would have ignited by lightning. We have those thunderstorms in the summer, the spring and growing season. So that's when most of them are really adapted to fires having occurred. Is that so more fire ecology than you wanted?
Not for me, but I mean, I just basically want to make the connection that once we start putting roads through places, people get real uptight about fire. So if they build this road through this area, what you're saying is we're not going to have prescribed burns or natural burns. So there's two ways we manage with fire in nature. One is nature does it all by itself, and a lightning strike, enough stuff ends up on the ground floor of the forest or the scrub or wherever, and it becomes kindling, deadfall, leaves, branches, a lightning strike ignites it, and all the things happen, a stand replacing fire or not, you get fire and it allows for new growth. And each ecosystem has evolved to respond to the way fire occurs naturally. And a lot of times, we see this a lot in on public land that is being managed appropriately, there will be what they call prescribed burns, where they will use drip torches or they will start a fire to kind of get ahead of what would happen naturally to avoid a fire that might be a little too big for surrounding areas. I know that we used to, I haven't seen it happen in a while, Fort DeSoto, where I live in Pinellas County, there are a couple of trails you can walk through and they would have signs up going last burn date. And they do that because they're trying to mimic what nature does. But exactly. Once we build a giant road through there and we start to see thousands or millions of cars a day, what you're saying is the odds are we're not going to do either of those things. We're not going to let a natural fire occur and burn as it would without a human interference. And we're certainly not going to do prescribed burns. Is that the thrust or am I misunderstanding?
That is it in a nutshell, yes. A land manager does not want to put a big cloud of smoke over a high-speed highway and potentially be responsible for the tragic consequences. So all those things, you know, putting smoke over a school or a nursing home or a highway, it just the more and more development intrudes on these areas where the land managers want to do the prescribed burning to mimic nature. Eventually, their hands are tied. It's just too difficult or dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the real thing, because this will be a death knell for this little tiny mint that, by the way, I had never seen a picture of it. It looks like a little orchid to me. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It's gorgeous.
Like when you say mint, I was thinking mint like what I rip, like I have little planters where I have my herbs growing, where I rip it off and put it in my tea or my water. This looks like this beautiful orchid that you don't know, it's gorgeous. Not that that matters. It shouldn't just be the charismatic plants we care about protecting, right? Like that's a big debate in conservation circles, but you know what I mean? It's really a lot. It's not what you expect when you say mint.
Yeah.
Without what you expect it. Y'all deal with it all the time. I don't. Sorry.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Just that, you know, it was described as a species not that long ago. And then people are now learning about it and only because they want to put a toll road.
Yeah, I'd never heard of it. So I was looking at the article on WFT. Part of this road would go right through a native plant nursery.
Yeah. So even so the ironic. Native options would go through the natives who provide plants for our restoration of the site. I mean, we've been doing restoration on this site to try and counteract the impact of invasives and encourage the mint to move into the under the power line right of way so that it has more habitat, because the research comes out. I sent you guys a link to include in the show notes. There's research on the future of this of species in this genus, and it's not looking good with climate change. And so, you know, we're trying to get ahead of that, not wait until there's an emergency, but with the way these roads are being planned, it's accelerating the emergency.
Yeah. And yet the site where we do have the Dicerandra now publicly owned, we're glad of that. But another important aspect of the natives' nursery, besides the fact that they produce, propagate a lot of these rare scrub endemic plants, is that a lot of their property is still natural, and they've protected it through a conservation easement. So it's not public land, but it is protected to the extent that they chose to put a conservation easement over it. And so this and other species are present on the property. A number of those other rare Lake Wells Ridge scrub endemic species that I had named. I think the pygmy fringe tree and scrub plum and a number of others also are present on that private property, which is protected but could have a road going through it. So it's kind of a double whammy, impacting both this privately owned property that has those species present and the only known publicly owned protected population of this one extremely rare mint.
This, and you know, the way that conservation is being looked at by these road building agencies is really worrying, because everyone's very excited about the Florida Wildlife Corridor, right? Wildlife corridor, this much land was saved, that much land was saved. How are all those lands being protected? Are they being purchased outright by the state? They're not. They're being protected under conservation easements.
So I noticed the article talks about split oak, which is a sore subject for a lot of people in Central Florida who care about the environment, where land was reserved and thought to be in perpetuity, but not so. I know Valerie's been involved with that. It's a bad precedent, I guess, is a way to say.
Yeah. And so split oak has many, many protections. I mean, it not only is it owned in fee simple, it has multiple conservation easements, gopher tortoise mitigation banking, gopher tortoise recipients. It is a gopher tortoise recipient site. There's Army Corps of Engineer permits tied to that. So we're ticking off the list of ways to protect land in Florida, and we're making them no longer able to be protected from roads. And if we're going to keep sprawling and being like, yeah, of course, oh, look at the population. Population's growing. Must need a new road. Need a new road through the Gallo National Forest. Need a road from Jacksonville to Gainesville.
Can we talk about how that actually doesn't work? I mean, forget about plants. Forget about ecosystems. Building more roads is not working. They're still just as screwed up and crappy and busy.
Yeah.
Trust me, I've lived my life driving I-4. I think we can all agree, I'm sorry. Yeah. I digress. Right.
You're not digressing. This is the crux of the problem, is that we have planning agencies planning for the past, not for the future.
Yes. That's the transportation infrastructure of the past, and we're building it for the future just because we're so locked into doing things the same way we've always done them. And so that's one of the most infuriating aspects of this. You know, DOT, of course, they have to plan for the future. In this case, though, they're looking at the year 2050, 25 years from now, predicting that the population of Polk County is going to double by then. And that's because of the recent surge in population growth. So it's based on this assumption that all that growth is going to occur, all those people are going to come there. And not only that, they're going to attend to all their daily needs by getting in a car and driving someplace. The same car-dependent paradigm that we're living under now. And I honestly believe that if we do things 25 years from now, exactly the way we're doing them today, which is exactly the way we did them 25 years ago, this mess we're in of sprawl and traffic congestion is just going to be that much more unwieldy and unsustainable.
I have very low blood pressure normally, like medically. This is probably my doctor's happy to see my blood pressure getting back up to normal levels, because this is so upsetting to me. I used to be on the board of a local historical society, and there was a board turnover, and we had a joke for a long time that if anybody ever gave a reason that was any echo of, well, we've always done it this way and it's worked, we had to put a dollar in a jar. It was our version of a swear jar. And I feel like that's what we're doing with infrastructure in Florida is, well, we've always done it this way, so why not? And it's like, no, it's not working.
Right. And that's exactly it. They looked at these projections of population growth and then project out all those new people are all driving cars. And that's going to create massive congestion on especially U.S. Highway 27 through Polk County. So we have to build another road so that U.S. 27 won't be congested in the year 2050. Without thinking about how do we just get people out of their cars? How do we develop? There's all kinds of new development taking place there. Well, how do we develop in ways so people can walk to a store or to work or have some other, public transportation, mass transportation options? It's all car based. And unless you dismiss climate change as a hoax, right now about a third of all our carbon emissions come from our use of motor vehicles. So we're just going to double that in the future. It's insanity. I'm sorry, we're digressing.
We are digressing, but there's this cute little plant this beautiful little plant. And, you know, I know the argument, which I don't think we have a lot of these people listening to our podcast who would make this argument, what does it matter? And so years ago, I wrote an article about the Toria tree, which is one of my trees that make me cry trees. I wrote an article for a newspaper about the Toria tree. And in the process of doing that, I asked a botanist, why does it matter? Like, literally, why does it matter if this tree goes away? Not because I think it doesn't matter, but what do you say to that? And the answer, which I wish we could give a more concrete answer, like, oh, it has the phytochemicals that will do this and cure cancer. But you never know what you're losing. You know, and also the less diversity we have on the globe, you're screwed. So you don't, it's, you know, I remember years ago, I don't know if you remember this, but it came to light, and I'm putting air quotes around this, that McDonald's was bulldozing the rainforest. And everybody lost their mind at how many acres of the rainforest was being destroyed every hour. And all these plants that might hold the cure or might save the planet one day or might this. And there was all this outrage. And I think about that a lot because I'm like, well, what about, you know, I don't know where y'all live. I live in Gulfport, Florida, which is by St. Petersburg, which of course, one of the main ways to get there is the Howard Franklin. And I watched how much they ripped out just to include the third span of the Franklin. And I'm like, where's the outrage for all the things we're destroying here? Like everybody was so worried about the rainforest. What was that, 30 years ago? I don't know. This little plant, what if it is one of those things? What if it's, you know, what if there's something in this plant that could do something good? And I guess we don't care. Is that the answer? Or policymakers don't care? What does it matter if it goes away? Right? That's what difficult. I'm asking.
It's difficult when somebody wants to pose that question. Well, what does this species matter? Who cares? Well, you're right. We just don't know. And, you know, there's this one line that ecologists use, you know, nature isn't just more complex than we know. It's more complex than we can know. We can't see all the different relations.
I like that.
There. And, you know, the part that I think got lost because he didn't hit record in time, but Rick was talking about he planted some passion flower vine, right?
Yeah.
Well, and I was going to remark, well, if with any luck, it's going to get eaten up by Gulf fritillary caterpillars.
Yeah.
I mean, if you lose the passion flower vine, do you like Gulf fritillary butterflies? Well, then you need passion flower vine for their caterpillars to eat, or you won't have any butterflies. It's just all the connections in nature. That's what ecology is. And so, you know, another famous line, I think it was Aldo Leopold, the first rule of intelligent tinkering is to keep all the pieces. And all these species are all the pieces of this, you know, most intricate machine, if you want to call it that there is. And so we don't know what's going to happen when we just let species go extinct, as if we have to see some direct benefit or use or value, or they're not worth saving.
Thank you for saying that. I think that's so crucial because, you know, we're all connected. I don't believe anything evolved on this planet by accident. I'm not necessarily a huge fan of intelligent design. I'm not sure that I'll go that far. You know, I don't think there was some benign overlord or not so benign overlord who thought, you know, got high and invented a platypus or whatever people think. But I think everything evolved in concert, and I think everything is here for a reason. And, you know, we just don't know what it is. I'm going to put that in the show notes just so people can read it again. Nature isn't just more complex than we know. It's more complex than we can know. And, you know, like the passion flower, honestly, I forgot about the butterfly. I knew it, but I forgot until you reminded me. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. You know, that's what you need. And, same thing like with the kunti, which is, I always thought was a very odd palm tree until, what is it, the Atala butterfly? I don't even know if I'm saying that right.
Yeah.
Isn't that what it needs? Like, you wouldn't think about that. People
No.
planted it because it was a good landscaping plant, not because of anything else.
Yeah, and when you look at the leaves, it's like, how does a caterpillar eat these giant thick leaves? Because we don't have the butterfly here. I've got the plants everywhere, but I don't have the the butterfly. And it just, to me, like, I get it. I have passion flower vine, the corky stem all over, and you see the little guys just crunching down and eating them up. But it's remarkable to me that anything could eat a Kunti leaf, and that's another ancient plant right there. You know, another one that's been around for gazillion years.
Yeah, pre-Columbian, that was the Kunti root. Isn't that what they used? Because they did not have wheat flour. Didn't they use the Kunti root for, they would grind it up. But I mean, I tried to buy some this weekend thinking I'll do my part. You know, it's not, I don't find it to be the most attractive plant, but you know what? I do like butterflies. And they were like, no, we don't have that. Can we get, what about a cardboard palm? I'm like, no, I don't. Thank you. No, you know, it's too easy. But anyway, mint. I think, did we talk about how the mint is edible in small amounts?
Small amounts, yes. We did
small amounts, and
make a tea, but don't put it in your salad.
Do not make a mint casserole. Yes,
no.
Mint casseroles do not taste good.
But don't eat it at all because it's protected federally.
It's protected. I mean, I don't know. I have Toria trees now. I mean, as long as we're talking about wildly endangered Florida plants, I have Toria trees that so far we're a month in, they're living their best lives. So, and you know, that's a direct result of a botanist who came on the podcast a couple months ago and said, oh yeah, they're growing where I live.
Is there any chance this could be commercially propagated so that we could get it at a native plant nursery?
Yeah, so we've discussed that. You know, the thing about these mints, as they're recently evolved, they hybridize really easily. So we wouldn't want to just put them on a rack at Lowe's. Anybody could just buy them. That could be a big problem because, you know, Native Plant Society, we love the gardeners. We love people connecting with their yards. And we obviously have all of our members have native yards, basically. You know, I have a native yard. But our main goal is to protect what we have in the wild. And so, you know, we're not going to start something or encourage something that's going to cause a genetic problem, you know, with the other species of mints nearby.
I see.
And so we've been discussing.
Well, and also, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Valerie.
So we've been discussing this with a UF researcher on how the best way to, you know, get these plants out. And so it's not a single site endemic anymore and, you know, get more genetic diversity and more geographic diversity in this plant's range.
What I would also suggest gently, no disrespect to big corporate box stores, that Lowe's and Home Depot is not where you want these things, because that, you know, I would think more of like a Wilcox or some of the small family nurseries where they can say, hey, this is what you do with it. Because also one of the problems you have, I always think about the python, you know, people, law of unintended consequences. We have python here. We don't want them, but they are an endangered species in their native habitat. But right organism in the wrong place can take over. And so I would hate to see a situation where we have this endemic blushing scrub bomb and it takes over and obliterates some other part in some other environment where, well, people make the mistake of thinking, well, it's native to Florida. I can plant it anywhere in Florida. And that is definitely not the case.
Yeah,
so
there are three or four other Dicerander species that are also listed federally as threatened or endangered. So the point Valerie made about hybridization, you actually can lose a species if they're closely related enough where they will reproduce together. Then you end up losing the genetic integrity species. They all be just hybridize until you have something new, and you've basically lost what nature had assembled.
What can people do at this point? Public comment has ended. You know, can't fight City Hall, right? They're going to do whatever they want to do. What should people be asking, demanding, and who should they be asking and or demanding it of?
Right. Well, so DOT, the Florida Turnpike Enterprise, an arm of DOT responsible for all those toll roads, which we have more of than any other state, This was the planning phase that they are completing. And this last step of the planning phase is, I think ACE is the acronym, Alternative Corridor Evaluation. So they started with a number of different corridors. And after, you know, reviewing all the information that's been provided to them and taking all the public comment, they'll pick their preferred corridor. And they're projecting to do that by the last quarter of this year. So you know, October, November, December, somewhere in there, presumably the Turnpike Enterprise will announce which of these alternative corridors they've chosen. And that launches the next phase, PD&E, project development and the environmental assessment phase. And that will again be taking some public comment. So, I mean, we have to be poised when they come out with that to once again go on the attack. We told them the only of the four alternatives, we wanted A. That was the one that it would take out a Publix grocery store, but not endangered species habitat. That was the first.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, me. I'm good.
that's the first one they took off the table because you got to protect the
public. Because Publix lobbies.
Well, it is yeah. Polk County. You know, that's their home turf.
So, yes. And so they eventually came to this point where they also ruled out D, which was the most problematic one. That's the one that would have gone right through the mint habitat, which left B and C. And then B and C are off the table and they're looking at E and F, which are basically B and C, just with some little wiggles, different wiggles to them. And they might make them a little more, well, a little less horrible than they were before, but they're still, they'd still create those circumstances where it would probably be impossible to continue burning that habitat into the future. But so once they come out and announce which of these corridors they're choosing, we still have to go right back to what has been our position, that we say either no build or go with alternative A and buy out the Publix and whatever other development, because you know we can't just keep living with public lands being the path of least resistance.
Yeah,
the first choice for where you're going to build the new road or the new pipeline or the new whatever.
I was going to just suggest an alternative. We just secure the borders of Polk County and don't let anybody else move in, and then we don't have a problem. Of course, those roads you're talking about, I've done the drive down 27 to, you know, in the part through Davenport. It's pretty much hell now, you know, but the simple solution is just stop people from moving into Florida. Of course, I mean, it's not simple. I'm just joking. But I honestly, as bad as it is now, I wouldn't want to see to drive through Polk County with double the people, because it's hard to get around enough. It makes me sad.
Yeah. Well, at some point it's so hard to get around or so unlivable, people will quit moving there.
Yeah. I don't think we're far from that, honestly. You know, anywhere you drive in Florida, they've tried to get me to do talks, and you know, if I had a helicopter, Lakeland would be pretty close, but by I-4, it's just a nightmare getting there. And
I have a solution. I have a two-word solution, but nobody wants to hear it. Well, three words: state income tax.
Hmm. Interesting.
I mean, that's one of the main reasons it is so appealing to people. Look, I understand it was appealing to move by the springs, the forest, or the beach, but there are a lot of parts of Florida that I guarantee you people are not moving there because of the remaining natural beauty. It's cheap to live here.
Yeah.
Even with property taxes. I mean, it's with the Save Our Homes cap, you know, you come down, you buy a house, you live in it, you occupy it, Save Our Homes, all the exemptions local governments are giving people if they're over 62, if they're veterans, if they're this, if they're that. It's very inexpensive to live here. There should be a cost to paradise. It is not a God-given right or guaranteed in the Constitution. You all get to live in paradise. I mean, that sounds very exclusionist, and I know I was not born here. I've been here since I was 7 years old. I know I'm not the only transplant who wants to slam the door behind them, but it's a problem. We'd need to change our state constitution, and we're certainly not going to do that. There's not a politician on this planet other than Clinton Tyree who would suggest a state income tax. So it's we're not even following our own laws about what the water management districts, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, aren't they the ones that are supposed to say yay or nay to developments if the infrastructure is not in place? Like if we don't have the ability to provide infrastructure, they're not supposed to build. And I mean, that's a lovely law that's been very well ignored since I think day one.
Yeah, well, that was actually the Department of Community Affairs that would have to enforce concurrency, as they called it. That went by the wayside. Yes, most of our growth management regulations are just gone. But the water management districts do have to plan to have enough water there to support the coming population. And, you know, there's a lot of thirsty St. Augustine grass. You've got to irrigate.
Yeah.
That's where half our water goes.
There's a great map on the Florida Native Plant Society Facebook page that has those different routes that Gene was talking about, the A, B, C, D, F, E. There's a whole bunch of them that it visualizes what he was saying. And I was looking at them and I see the A that went away, and did you say D went away quickly? D was the worst, and A was the
least bad.
The least bad. So it's, if you want to see that for yourself, go to Facebook and join the Florida Native Plant Society, and you can see it.
Now I'm going to put, we have the link to their Instagram post, and from there people can join.
Okay.
That can we possibly put the FDOT plans for the parkway in the show notes so that people can see what the options are and how they can follow along? You know, I'm not sure what the best way to do that, because I'm finding a lot written about it, but I'd like to find the actual government website and be able to put that on there and make it accessible to people. So if we can, folks, we will put those in the show notes for you.
Okay.
We also have a sign up for advocacy for FNPS. I created a form for people to sign up so that they can be notified of upcoming public meetings and organizational meetings that we will hold.
Yes, that's already in our links. We're very excited about this episode. And I want to find this plant. Do you think it would be irresponsible to tell people how to go find this plant in the wild, or would you rather let it be happenstance if people?
I mean, it's in a public park. You know, anybody can go see it. So,
which park is that?
It's called Horse Creek Scrub, or it has various names. Horse Creek Scrub, east of Davenport.
And yes, and using park is kind of a generic term. It's actually, as Valerie explained, it's managed by the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. It is hunted. It's a wildlife management area. That's a designation in contrast to a state park. So it's not as developed to accommodate public access and use like a state park would be. It's a little more primitive, but yes, you can drive up to it and park and hike on in.
And it is a wildlife management area, folks. Once again, that means there's hunting. Please do not dress like a deer.
Yeah, the lucky thing is we're kind of between hunting seasons now.
What about hog?
They might be doing some special hog hunts. I don't know.
Yes. At least, so,
yeah. No deer, well, turkey.
Look, just be sensible. But yeah, so that's fascinating, is that you can still go see it and all that. But thank you both for coming on the podcast. This was very informative, and I hope that it doesn't go as badly as we think it is. Folks, refer to the show notes for a picture of this pretty little plant, not so pretty, or not so little, what you can do, get more background, and how you can interact with, you know, how you can witness this in the last remaining place really on the planet, right? This is the last place on the planet you can go in the wild and see this plant.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great. And I just want to thank Valerie and Jean and the Florida Native Plant Society for fighting the good fight continually.
Yes.
It has to be discouraging at times in this state, but you guys are, you know, doing great work and we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you both so much for coming on. I know you had to rearrange your schedules and that tells us how important this is to you that you did that. So thank you for coming on the podcast and being a part of it. And as Rick said, thanks. Thanks for caring.
Thank you so much for having us.
Enjoy
rearranging your podcast schedule for this issue.
Of course. Now, before we go, as always, we do want to thank our top tier supporters for supporting us every month. It's really important that you let us continue to do this because otherwise Rick and I would just be getting into all kinds of trouble across the state. So we definitely want to thank those of you who support us financially in no particular order. We're going to go with Michael Gargulak, Ryan Worthington, who is the host of the Florida Madcaps podcast and As Bad As It Gets. He's also a great guy to hike with if you have a sense of adventure. John Bowne, Angela Connolly, Natalie Zachrick, Davita Breyer, author of the wonderful Florida book Fiction Sinkhole, Leslie Hallweg, Carol Miller, Elise Smith, everybody's favorite YouTube channel, Bets Boys Adventure, Jacksonvilleonian Brian Woodall, Brad Sager, and Stephanie Hewley. Thanks for supporting us. And folks, you can always just hop on over to the podcast at buzzsprout.com and click that support button. And you too can get a shout out at the end of every episode and really funky Florida ephemera as Rick and I run across it in our wanderings. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Florida Spectacular.